Live from the College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences at Michigan State University, it is now time to go beyond the X's and the O's with WKAR's current sports.
You want to go after an athlete, one of my athletes, come after me. I'm a man. I'm 40.
My style is impetuous. My defense is impregnable.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game. When you try me with a sorry receiver like Crabtree, that's the result you're going to get.
Yes, did I express to them I was mad? I was furious. Just furious.
I know my wife will at least shut fake one time.
We talking about practice, not a game.
And I told our players, you need to be more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Looking in the mirror. Do I look good? I got my extra bands on. I got my other shoes on. Be a dog. We don't need no meows. We don't need no cats.
Here's your host, L. Martin.
What is up, beautiful people? My name is Ian Hawley, filling in for Al Martin today here on Current Sports. You are now locked in for the next hour, where we will be bringing you all the stories that concern you and your sports interests here this week and this weekend. We got some big news. Nick Ward is entering the NBA draft. If you haven't heard yet, you should come out from under your rock. That's the biggest news here at Michigan State this week. And Jaren Jackson Jr. still has not given any timetable as to his NBA decision. During this hour, we'll bring you our picks for the Final Four matchups this weekend, and we'll also talk about the new NFL catch rule and the decision by the NFL to no longer allow players to lead with their head. Pretty controversial. We'll also bring you Reflection Friday at the end of this hour. And by we, I mean myself. Current Sports production assistant John Simon is with me, and Isaac Constance, a familiar name, is back behind the glass in the captain's chair doing his engineering thing today.
Howdy.
And we've also got Tamar Davis, I see, has poked his head in the door. Tamar, if you'd like to come join us, you're more than welcome. Although, if you'd like to continue hiding in the back corner, as you usually do, I completely understand. Let's not waste any more time. Let's get right to it. Here are your current sports quick hit headliners. Start the headliners today. We're going to talk about Nick Ward and his decision to enter the 2018 NBA draft. He will submit his name, but he will not hire an agent. Ward put his name into the NBA draft, making him eligible to be selected in the June 21st draft. He will be able to start attending workouts with teams on April 24th and is eligible to compete in the NBA draft combine if selected from May 16th to the 20th in Chicago. He then has 10 days until the May 30th deadline to weigh his options and keep his name in or withdraw and return to Michigan State. Tom Izzo said, "I fully support Nick's decision to take the opportunity to explore his draft stock. He has continued to improve and has worked very hard over the last 2 years to put himself in this position. The process will allow him to receive direct feedback and an assessment as to where he stands in his dream to play at the highest level," end quote. In 35 games this season, Ward finished third on the team in scoring with 12.4 points per game and led the team with 7.1 rebounds, which ranked eighth in the Big Ten Conference. He connected on 64.8% of his field goals, which ranked second in the Big Ten, and was named an All-Big Ten third-team selection by the media and an honorable mention selection by the coaches. Jaren Jackson Jr. has not made a decision on whether he will return to Michigan State basketball for his sophomore year or enter the NBA draft. Jackson's father, Jaren Jackson Sr., said there is no timetable for his son to make the decision other than before the 11:59 p.m. April 22nd deadline. His father said, "We are having great ongoing family conversations as Jaren Jr. thinks about his opportunities ahead," he said in a text message on Thursday, yesterday. "We are so proud of him to be in this position, to have a true choice. The 6'11" forward earned Big Ten Freshman and Defensive Player of the Year's honors this year. And Jackson was averaging 10.9 points, 5.8 rebounds, 3 blocks, and just over 1 assist in 21.8 minutes per game, and is pegged among the top 5 in a number of mock drafts. Jackson is projected a lottery pick in this summer's draft. We're just one day away from the 2018 NCAA Men's Basketball Final Four. Villanova, Kansas, Michigan, and Loyola Chicago will all be having their open practices this afternoon. The first semifinal game between number 3 seed Michigan and number 11 seed Loyola Chicago will tip off in San Antonio tomorrow night at 6:09 Eastern Time. 1 seeds Villanova and Kansas will play shortly thereafter, and their tip is set for 8:49 p.m. Eastern Time. The championship game will take place on Monday at 9:20 Eastern, and all 3 games will be aired on TBS this year. Look at TBS raking in that money. MSU baseball will host Rutgers this weekend as they continue their Big Ten Conference action in the Spartans' first complete home conference series. Due to inclement weather, the Spartans and Scarlet Knights series schedule has been altered, and the teams will now play a doubleheader today starting at 12:05, with the second game starting approximately 30 minutes following the first game. Saturday's game is scheduled for 1:05, and the weekend schedule is still subject to change, so keep an eye on that one. MSU softball will host Indiana in a 3-game Big Ten series this weekend. The teams will play a Friday doubleheader and then conclude the series on Saturday at 1 p.m. Michigan State and Indiana meet for the 122nd time today, and as MSU trails the all-time series by a 56-65 margin. The Spartans have won 3 straight in the series, the two final games of the 2017 regular season, and then an 8-7 come-from-behind victory in the first round of the Big Ten tournament a week later. MSU went 1-2 in its first Big Ten matchup of 2018 at Nebraska last weekend and took the series finale 9-1 in 5 innings after falling to the Huskers by a score of 9-6 and 12-6 in the first 2 games. Well, we had to wait an extra day, but the Detroit Tigers 2018 season will finally open up today against the Pittsburgh Pirates. Jordan Zimmermann gets his first opening day start for the Tigers. The first pitch is set for just a couple of minutes from now at 1:10 p.m., and the weather looks like it's going to cooperate today, thankfully. We'll provide updates to you throughout the hour. Pittsburgh will start former Yankee Ivan Nova in today's season opener. Like the Tigers a few years ago, the Pirates are deciding to rebuild or try and contend. They traded Andrew McCutchen to the San Francisco Giants and Garrett Cole to the Houston Astros. The Detroit Pistons might have waited too long to start a series push for the playoffs, although they are hoping to at least make things interesting for the Milwaukee Bucks. Andre Drummond scored 24 points and pulled down 23 rebounds, and the Pistons beat the Washington Wizards 103-92 last night for their 5th win in 6 games. The Pistons remain 5 games behind the Bucks for the last Eastern Conference playoff spot. The Bucks won at Golden State last night as well. After a long, hard stretch of losses, the Detroit Red Wings are suddenly finding ways to win. While it may be a relief for the team, it is not a benefit for the organization in rebuilding mode and in need of a high-end draft pick. The Wings overcame an early deficit last night at KeyBank Center to stop the Buffalo Sabres 6-3. 6 different Wings scored, and Henrik Zetterberg picked up his 954th career point to tie Sergei Fedorov, one of my favorite Red Wings of all time, for fifth in Wings history. It's the first time since February 24th, 25th that the Wings have won two games in a row and bookends a stretch where they have gone 1-12-1 in their past 14 games. That does it for your current sports quick hit headliners. If you want to call in and share your thoughts on any of those, please call 517-355-WKAR. That's 517-355-9527. You can tweet us. You can tweet me at Ian Hawley, WKAR, or at Isaac Constance, I believe is your Twitter handle. Isaac's giving me the thumbs up. And John, do you want to plug your Twitter real quick?
Sure, you can tweet me at jsimon_21.
All right, and tomorrow, I believe, has a Twitter as well, but he's still hiding in the back corner, so we're not gonna talk to him today. All right, let's keep it moving here. Alright, so we're going to start off today with some Final Four discussion, and I'll start with the Loyola Chicago versus Michigan matchup, because I know that's what you all want to hear about. Loyola is statistically the best shooting team in the Final Four, shooting 51% from the field goal mark, and they're making 40% of their three-pointers. The Wolverines are second nationally in turning the ball over only 9.2 times per game. John Beilein is now making his second Final Four appearance in the last five seasons, something that I wish I could say the same for our beloved Tom Izzo. Both teams rank in the top 20 in defensive efficiency rating, Michigan at 4th and Loyola at 19th. The Ramblers have held their last 10 opponents to 68 points or fewer, and Michigan's opponents have only averaged 63.1 points per game this season and have only shot 42.4%. We'll talk more about that Michigan defense in a minute. The Ramblers haven't had to defend a stretch five player the likes of Mo Wagner all season. But the bench players for this game, I believe, will really make the difference. John Teske and Duncan Robinson give Michigan a combined 13 points per game off the bench. However, Loyola has a star on the bench of their own in Andre Jackson, who was the Missouri Valley Sixth Man of the Year last season, and is averaging 11 points per game this season, and is Loyola's leading scorer in the tournament. Talking about Michigan's defense, they have stifled opponents all season long, when really their defense has been the thing that's kept them in some games when they've had offensive struggles. If you watch the game against Florida State, Mo Wagner only made 3 of his 11 shot attempts, and really they had a poor shooting stretch at the end of the first half. If my memory serves me correctly. I think the difference in this game will be who can control the defensive side of the floor, and I think Michigan will have a pretty easy task of that if they play up to their full potential. John Simon, what do you think about this game? What are your thoughts? What are your predictions?
I agree with you, Ian. I think it's definitely going to be somewhat of a defensive stalemate. I think that the styles between these two Final Four games are going to be very different. I think Kansas-Nova, you're going to see a lot of scoring. I think it's going to be about the offense. It's going to be about the star players. But in this first game, Loyola versus Michigan, it's going to come down to the defense because, like you said, Michigan's defense saves them a lot in games. And, you know, you mentioned their offensive struggles, too, and they could run into some trouble. Because one team that I've heard a lot of experts compare Loyola to is Virginia. And, you know, despite their unfortunate ending to the season, some would say, being the first one to lose to a 16 seed, they play great defense. And the way that they work the ball around on offense as well, and the way that they produce their points, a lot of people say it's very similar to Loyola. So I think Michigan could definitely run into some struggles against that Loyola defense. And like you said, so while I agree with you that the defense will be important, Ian, I think really it's more on which team's offense is going to get hot first, Loyola or Michigan, because I think both defenses will certainly show up tomorrow night.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think if we see the Michigan team that we saw against Michigan State and in the Big Ten tournament, then they're going to have easy work with Loyola Chicago. But if we see the inconsistent, poor shooting Michigan team that can't really find their offensive rhythm, I think this game could be really interesting. And we could be looking at a number 11 seed in the national championship game.
What's also interesting, too, is that these are the two teams with the longest win streaks in the country. So something's got to give. One of these two, both of these teams are, they're arguably the two hottest. You know, they've got the two longest win streaks. And it's going to be interesting to see if one team just folds or if they both show up to play.
I agree. It'll be a battle of mental toughness this Saturday. Tamar Davis, what are your thoughts on this? This Michigan-Loyola matchup?
Well, like John said, this would be a battle of the defensive schemes. I really think Michigan will have to really focus in on not turning the ball over, because that's something that they're huge at doing. And Loyola would just have to focus in on finding their weak points in terms of positioning, because these both of these teams really match up really great against each other. And also Michigan star player, you have to show up, Mo Wagner. You have to show up and, you know, be dominant as much as he can.
I agree. He's been a little inconsistent in this tournament at times, but they've had a lot of help from players like Duncan Robinson, Muhammad Ali Abdul-Rahman, try and say that five times fast, and John Teske has been really good for them as well as Jalen Simpson. So I think Michigan's guards will match up very well with the Loyola Chicago guards and vice versa. But I think the area that's going to give Loyola the most trouble is Mo Wagner. So I think he is the X factor for this Michigan team in this game. Again, if he has a good game, Michigan's going to make easy work of Loyola. Sorry, Sister Jean, I hate to break it to you, but Michigan is the more physically imposing team in this matchup. But if Wagner struggles, then Loyola has that in to make their guards sweat a little bit and try and pound them from the outside with their shooting ability. As I say, they're the best shooting team in the Final Four, shooting 51% from the field goal range and 40% of their threes. Isaac Constance, the man behind the glass, what are your thoughts on this matchup? I know you have something to say about this Michigan team after being out of the country for so long and having to watch them beat us twice this year.
Yeah, fortunately, wasn't able to watch half those games. So
and good for you.
Not too much to say on that note. Yeah, but Michigan, actually, I had them go into the championship in my Final Four bracket. So I'm picking against pride right now when I'm going for that, because you either got to go with your bracket. My friend's girlfriend is right now the highest-ranked team. My only chance to beat her is if Michigan gets into the championship game. So I am conflicted when it comes to this game. But when you look at the matchup itself, much of what's already been said holds true. It's going to be about offense, because the thing is, when you score 60 points a game in a tournament game, you're not going to ask that much more of your defense. It's about making sure you outscore the opposition. Both of these teams have relied on individual performances as well. So when it comes down to it, when push comes to pull, whatever the expression is that you want to use, you need one player to step up. And throughout this tournament, Michigan has relied on one player. Mo Wagner can either make or break this team. We've seen that before. So again, Loyola Chicago, a team that heavily relies on guard play, spread them out across the court. They've got, I think, five players on their team actually who average in double digits for the season. So it's about for them breaking that Michigan defensive scheme and making sure that they get good ball movement. They do not turn it over that often. Overall, as a team, they're pretty decent. They're pretty safe when it comes to that account. So we'll just see who can take this one over. Unfortunately, I do think that Michigan has the advantage in this game, because who doesn't want to see a tournament run like Loyola Chicago has had? But teams that have made it in the past from a similar seed tend to collapse right at the Final Four stage. This is when we see the elite teams ascend. I remember the 2006 tournament, in fact, when LSU, my beloved Tigers, and then you also had George Mason, both in the Final Four. Both teams got destroyed. And it's simply because when, again, push comes to shove, there's your expression, it's about elite players, NBA talent. Michigan's got a few of them. Michigan really does. And John Beilein's been there before. He knows what he's doing. Whereas Loyola Chicago, as much as I love the team, the thing is, they don't have a single player who I still think will make it in the NBA. It's a Cinderella story. So when you look at that, I'm going with Michigan.
All right. Well, we've heard Isaac's pick. I am also picking Michigan in this game. And I actually had them in my national championship game as well. I had them going up against the Spartans, mainly because I wanted Michigan State to, you know, go 1-for-3 against them this season at least. So hopefully half of that prediction will come true, and I can somehow salvage some points in my bracket because Lord knows it's not looking good for me right now. John Simon, what's your pick for this game? Who you got?
As much as I want to go against you two and pick the running Ramblers of Loyola Chicago, I do think that Michigan is also going to win this game. I wanted to pick them in my bracket a while back. I think I mentioned it on the show that I was convinced Michigan would go on a Final Four run. But then I thought, you know, I really liked the North Carolina Tar Heels. But so I backed off on Michigan, and clearly I regret it because my national champion Villanova Wildcats are still in. So if I could have picked those two teams right, maybe I'd be winning my bracket. But overall, I definitely think that Michigan comes out with the win this one. Like I said, I don't know how it's going to be. I don't think it's going to be a blowout win by any means. I think that this is going to be a grinded-out dogfight, as some would call it. But ultimately, I think the Wolverines make their way to the national championship game.
All right, John is picking Michigan as well. And Tamar, last but not least, who you got?
Man, I would love to see Michigan in the the championship game, but I'm not rooting for them. I'm actually rooting for Loyola. In my bracket, I have Kansas winning the entire thing, and I'm in second place, and the person that I'm tied with actually has Michigan going to the championship game. So if Michigan loses, I'm going to be ahead of that person. So
okay.
I'm rooting for Loyola to, take out the competition for me.
It's a little bit of self-interest there.
Yeah.
That's nothing wrong with that. It is March Madness after all. All right, if you'd like to call in and weigh in on anything you've just heard, 517-355-9527 is the number. Let's move on to the other matchup in this Final Four weekend, and that would be the Kansas Jayhawks versus the Villanova Wildcats in a matchup of the number one seeds. Kansas is coming off a big win over Duke, 85-81 in the Elite Eight. A game that went to overtime. The Jayhawks won the Big 12 regular season and conference tournament titles in a league that was arguably the best in the country this season. Devontae Graham is Kansas's leading scorer at 17.2 points per game and also averages 7.3 assists. Sviatoslav Mikhailuk, correct me if I'm wrong on that one, I probably butchered that, is averaging 14.7 points and 4 rebounds each game. And Malik Newman is also putting up 14 points per game, although he has put up big numbers in the NCAA tournament, so that stat might be a little bit misleading as he's shown great improvement in this tournament. Villanova was ranked number one for much of the season, and they have won each game of this tournament by at least 12 points. Jalen Brunson leads the bunch for Jay Wright's team this year, averaging 19.2 points and shooting 53% from field goal range. Michael Bridges, the other Bridges that we've heard about all season long, is second in scoring with 17.8 points, and he shoots 51.2% from the field. Senior guard Dante DiVincenzo is averaging almost 13 points, and the Wildcats are also getting double-digit scoring from Omari Spellman, Eric Paschal, and Phil Booth. So, two very good offensive teams here in this Final Four matchup. Clearly, Villanova has no lack of scoring from any of their players. And Kansas is really led by Devontae Graham, and I think Mikhailuk is, kind of the second in command there, although the argument could also be made for Newman. I'm looking at this game, and having watched Kansas all year, I was unsold on them coming into this tournament just because of some of their earlier losses in the season. I know that might be a little bit unfair to penalize them for their non-conference schedule, as some teams really put it together during conference play. And clearly Kansas has, having won both the regular season and conference tournament titles. And then you look at Villanova, and they're a scary bunch. I'm honestly glad that Michigan State didn't make it this far, so we wouldn't have gotten embarrassed by Villanova, because I believe that's what would have happened. Michael Bridges would have been the better of the two Bridges on the floor, in my opinion, because really Miles didn't have that killer mentality that we all wanted to see. But moving on away from my heartbreak with Michigan State basketball, John Simon, what are your thoughts on this matchup, and who do you have as the winner?
First, I love it. Like I said, I don't know if I really made light of it when we were talking earlier about Michigan and Loyola, but I am way more excited for this game between two one seeds. And what excites me the most about it is, you know, as much as we love seeing the one and done players in college basketball and, you know, the big NBA prospects, you know, the next great 18-year-old that's just going to play one season, possibly a top five pick. But players that help you win in college basketball a lot are veterans, 3-4 year players. And the leader of your team is typically your point guard. And I think that this game between Kansas and Villanova has the two best point guards in the country, with Devontae Graham and Jalen Brunson. And what I think it comes down to is which one of those guys is going to lead their team. But like you said, Ian, there's a lot of talent surrounded around those two point guards. And honestly, even though I have Villanova winning, I'm all of a sudden really scared of this Kansas Jayhawks team. Like you said, I wrote them off all season long. I thought they were down. I thought that they weren't the best team in the Big 12. And lo and behold, they still win the conference title in the regular season. They still win the conference tournament. Bill Self has these guys rolling. I mean, I thought even in the tournament, they looked sluggish against, they started off slow against Penn. They had trouble finishing off Seton Hall and Clemson, but after showing that fight against Duke, and, you know, despite, honestly, people could think Duke could have won that game with that Grayson Allen buzzer beater that rimmed out at the end, but even still, showing that fight in overtime and just the balance that they have on offense, you know, aside from Graham, Mikhailu's great. Malik Newman has reached a whole new level. And LeGerald Vick, that's a guy who could go in the first round of the NBA draft. So with all that talent and the way they're playing, I'd hate to say it, but I think the Jayhawks are going to advance over my championship pick, the Villanova Wildcats.
So not looking good for your bracket there.
My bracket is long, long gone. It's toasted. I'm just here for good basketball now.
And Tamar Davis, what do you think about this matchup?
This is a heavyweight match right here. I'm like John said, I really love this. I would have hoped for this to be the championship game, kind of like the Duke versus Kansas game. But this is going to be something special. I really like to see Malik Newman show up again like he did in the Duke game. Coming from Mississippi State, you know, he was highly recruited, 5-star recruit coming out of high school, a lot of hoop mixtapes. This guy was really the truth coming out of high school. Going to Mississippi State, I think he followed his father to Mississippi State, and he's from Mississippi. He didn't really have that great of a season his freshman year. You know, transferred to Kansas, had to sit out a year. And then, you know, he's arrived. You know, he's here. And not only that, but he showed up where he needed to show up against Duke. And I want to say he's having a career high in every category except for assists and three-point attempts. So I'm picking Kansas to win this game, not just for my bracket, but, you know, just off the eye test, Villanova is a great team. And not only that, but they can really shoot the lights out. But if they're not shooting, you know, how they're supposed to shoot, or if their shots aren't going in and they have to go inside, I don't think that they're going to be able to handle, you know, what Kansas can do in terms of going inside with their team.
Do you think it'll be a blowout win for Kansas, or do you think it'll be a close game?
It depends on what type of Villanova team shows up. You know, if the same Villanova team that showed up against, who did they play last before this game?
I want to say Texas Tech.
Yeah, if it's the same Villanova team that played Texas Tech, then I think Kansas can run away with the game with a nice margin win. But if it's that number one Villanova team we know during the regular season, then we're going to have something similar to the Duke versus Kansas game.
All right, Isaac Constance, what are your thoughts on this matchup? I know you're a big fan of the Blue Blood matchup here.
I never thought I'd be the only guy picking Villanova, but I mean, come on. Villanova has not had a game this season since February 28th, where they cut it to single digits. A margin of victory of single digits or a loss. This is a college basketball team that's a one seed, went through a tough bracket, beat West Virginia down. I mean, outscored them easily, 90-78. This is a team that's tested. It's a blue blood. I'm giving them respect. I mean, come on, Jalen Brunson, like John Simon said, one of the best point guards in the entire nation. Then you keep on going down that roster, and every single player is a scoring threat. They burn you from deep, and they play with pace. And they're, again, a favorite because they've repeated again and again in terms of making amends in the regular season for, you know, whatever happened in the year before, and then somehow surpassing their performance in the tournament. And they've proven to be clutch. They've got, you know, veteran players. There's nothing about this team that I don't think has been proven yet. I've got to go with them because they've made all of their opponents look small, slow. And then Bridges, you talk about him. He's one of the best players in the nation. Easily going to be a high draft pick as well. I just love this team all around. Love Jay Wright as a coach. I'm picking Villanova to win this. And I don't think it's going to be that close of a game even.
All right. Isaac's calling for a Villanova blowout. And just to give you our regular host Al's picks, he is going with Michigan and Villanova also this weekend. And I don't know if I gave my pick, but I think I'm going to go with Kansas, but only by a slim margin. Just because, I mean, you talk about the wins that they've had in this conference tournament. Kansas has had some pretty good wins of their own as well. And I highlighted that Duke game. But they've played some good teams in the Big 12 regular season as well. And I'm just disappointed by the schedule that Villanova plays during their conference season, you know? Sure, they've had multiple, or since February 25th, you said, was?
28th, yeah.
28th. They've had double-digit wins in every game. But it reminds me too much of this Michigan State team that we had this season, where 23 of their 30 wins were outside of the RPI top 100. And I'm not saying Villanova has faced anywhere near that horrible level of opponents, but clearly they haven't gone up against the same consistent level of competition that we've seen from the Big 12 this season, which I think was one of the two, if not the best, conference in college basketball this year, the other being the ACC. Sadly, the Big Ten is not anywhere up there in that discussion, as Michigan was really the only team with a shot, in my mind, to make it to the Final Four and make it to the national championship, just because I wasn't sold on that North Carolina team, and I don't think Xavier should have been a number one, just because they got beat down by Villanova so badly during the season. But that's a conversation for another day. We can move on. If you'd like to call in and give us your thoughts on these Final Four matchups for tomorrow, 517-355-9527 is the number. Let's hit our first break. When we come back, we'll be talking about the NFL's rule changes made this week, specifically the updated catch rule and the decision by the NFL to enforce a penalty if players lead with their helmet. You're listening to Current Sports on AM 870. This is WKAR. We're back here on Current Sports. My name is Ian Hawley, and I'm filling in for Al Martin today. He's away visiting his family in Miami for this Easter holiday weekend. Before the break, we were talking about the Final Four matchups, but now we're going to transition here and talk about the rule changes that have come this week in the National Football League. They've made a change to the catch rule. The survive the ground requirement has now been eliminated, a change designed to specifically avoid future instances of counterintuitive rulings that spurred debate about players involving Detroit Lions receiver Calvin Johnson in 2010. Also, Dez Bryant has had some issues with these rulings. and most recently Pittsburgh Steelers receiver Jesse James in 2017. Now a receiver must control the ball, establish himself in bounds, and perform a football move, such as a third step or a lunge, to make a legal catch. This definition applies to players who remain standing or are going to the ground. It will remain eligible for replay review, and analysts believe this change makes the rule objective, but others, including former officiating chief Dean Blandino, think it will simply swap one set of debates out for another. Most notably, did the receiver in fact perform a, quote, football move? I'm not so sure I like this rule change, simply because I agree with the argument that this will just create a whole nother set of issues for the National Football League. I mean, what necessarily are we considering a football move here? Does a player have to perform a full spin or a stiff arm? Or is simply another step going to count as a football move? And I think the replay will make this a little bit better. I didn't really like the argument that you had to control the ball all the way through the ground, just simply because when you're making an outstretched catch, it's very hard if you have a loose grip on the ball as it is to begin with, even with the nice wide receiver gloves that they have nowadays. It's very hard to keep a tight grip on that all the way through the ground. So I like the fact that they're trying to make a change and they're actively thinking about the fans and the officiating crews here and trying to make it a little bit easier on them. But I don't necessarily think the term football move will clear anything up for people. I think they need to establish, all right, if the third step is what we're going for here, then you have to take three steps every time you catch the ball. Otherwise, you don't catch the ball. Or if a lunge is what we're going for, or whatever the case may be, I think we need a little bit more definitive answer than a football move, because that just kind of leaves things up in the air. John Simon, what do you think of this rule change?
I agree with you a little bit that it puts to rest debates on one topic about this whole what is a catch, what is not, and then it just brings up more. Overall, I think that it's at least good that they've addressed the rule and that the NFL is, you know, trying to find a way to make this rule better and to make it work more and for there to be less arguments and less problems with it. But the problem that's always going to happen is that, you know, after this rule is changed and, you know, like you said, people are still going to be wondering what exactly is a football move. The problem with it is that no matter what, there's always going to be problems with this. And I think that the biggest thing is replay. I wish that as bad as officials can be sometimes in sports, and the NFL officials have, of course, had a lot of scrutiny thrown at their way over the past few years. But I just wish that people would give more trust in the officials, you know, like have faith that their judgment call, their first instinct call usually is the right one. And when you overthink things, when you overlook things and there's replay all the time, you know, I don't think that replay is as helpful as people think. You know, just going off the catch rule, going into the other big rule that they talked about in the owners' meetings this week, the 15-yard penalty for lowering the head to initiate contact with a helmet, you know, this is changing the way that a lot of players actually learn how to tackle. And, you know, when you slow down replay and you take a look at how guys are hitting or how cornerbacks are defending receivers, that can oftentimes, you know, almost alter how the play is actually being made. So I think overall with this revised standard for catch, I think it's better than the rule that they had before. But like you said, Ian, I do think that there will still be a lot of debate sparked over, you know, whatever issues arise in this new rule change.
Yeah, I've heard the argument that the more you slow things down, the more you can see what you want to see.
Right.
And we've seen that a lot in the NBA as well, with some of the charging or blocking type calls that they make, or some of the flagrant foul calls that they make where a player is trying to clear their space with their elbows out and they accidentally make contact with someone's head or someone's shoulders. And the more you slow things down, the more you start to determine quote-unquote intent with what that player was trying to do. And so I think in a lot of cases, unless the catch is in a game-changing situation, you know, in the last 2 minutes of the game, then maybe that's where they should employ the instant replay. I think that would save a lot of the controversy from the officials as far as, you know, reversing their own calls or not wanting to reverse their own calls or whatever the case may be. And I'll talk about this 15-yard penalty rule since you brought it up. The new rule says that there will be a 15-yard penalty for any player lowering their head to initiate or make contact with their helmet. For the moment, the biggest takeaway is a little bit more confusion, again, like this this revised rule for a catch. It's now a foul when a player lowers his head to quote-unquote initiate and make contact with his helmet against an opponent. It will cost 15 yards and could, as with the NCAA's targeting rule, lead to an ejection. What remains to be decided by the NFL's May 21st to 23rd meetings, would ejections be mandatory or would they be based on the severity of the hit, such as in basketball with a flagrant 1 and a flagrant 2 penalty? Would those ejections be subject to replay? How strictly will the officials enforce the rule? You know, there's a lot of running backs, when they're trying to gain extra yards, will lower their head to try and drive with their legs and gain some leverage in like a wrestling style move. You know, in wrestling, if you put your legs back and you lean forward with your head and you can put your head on someone's hip, you pretty much have full control over where you want them to go. So that's been the mentality with a lot of running backs. But now, any lowering of the head by an offensive player or a defensive player will immediately result in a penalty, according to this rule. So I guess we'll have to wait a little while for the NFL season to start and see how strictly they're going to enforce that rule. But I can see where they're coming from a player safety standpoint, as far as not wanting players to initiate contact with their head or the crown of their helmet. There's been a lot of debate, not really debate, but talk of the amount of concussions and the prevalence of CTE in a lot of current and former NFL players. And I can see how this rule would help to cut down on the amount of head-to-head contact or the amount of leading with the head contact that happens so often in the NFL. But you're taking away a big part of the game for offensive players, which is being able to use their leverage by lowering their body and trying to drive that defensive player backwards. Tamar, what do you think about this rule, this catch rule or this lowering of the head rule?
Well, I can start with the catch rule. It has its pros and cons. The pros is that, you know, they're actually noticing, you know, they're paying attention to this rule, seeing that, you know, a lot of people caught the short end of the stick regarding that rule. A lot of teams lost games because of that rule. But the cons are you don't really know, you know, what a football move is. So I read an article and they explain what they meant by football move. And I want to say the standard for a catch has changed so that a catch will be considered completed when the receiver gets control of the ball, gets 2 feet or another body part on the ground inbounds, and completes a football move, third step, reach, extending for the line to gain or having the ability to do so. So basically they're saying you have to have full body control and know what you're doing as soon as you catch the ball, which is kind of difficult because you don't even know if you're going to catch the ball unless you're Julio or, you know, someone with that.
Yeah, there's only a few receivers with that level of confidence.
Exactly. So that's pretty difficult on the player's part. So I feel like they should clean up that tad part, just a little bit, to make it more specific. And in terms of the lowering of the head to initiate contact with the helmet is a foul rule. I get it in terms of someone who's a defensive player and they're trying to tackle. If I'm a cornerback or safety and I have a running back coming at me and he's basically beast mode or he's someone that's looking to truck me, how would I stop that? And I can't think of another way to tackle someone without lowering your head or, you know, trying to stop them.
Exactly,
with your
trying
full
to get some
force.
Leverage on them.
Exactly. So if I'm an offensive person, I mean, it could be dangerous, you know, for an offensive player lowering their head and trucking someone. I never like that unless I'm playing Madden. So,
And with this football move, are we going to see now if you catch the ball and you have 2 feet in bounds, but you're tiptoeing on the sidelines, if you can't make a quote unquote football move by extending the ball or whatever the case may be, is that no longer going to be ruled a catch, even though you got 2 feet in bounds? Like, so if someone's leaning back over their head to try and catch a ball and they happen to get 2 tiptoes down as they slide out of bounds, are we going to see that be called an incomplete catch?
Right. Or was the Odell catch, is that considered a...
Gets one hand over the back of his head and only gets 1 foot down?
Yeah.
Or two, and barely gets the other foot down before he falls out of bounds in the end zone? Is that going to be ruled an incomplete catch now because he didn't have time to complete a quote-unquote football move? I mean, I'm just seeing a lot of gray areas in this new ruling as well. And it will help to clear up some things, but... I think it's going to create a little bit more controversy in others. Isaac Constance, what do you think?
Well, the NFL needs to just employ some common sense for a change. And the thing is, when you play football out in the park, it's not that complicated. A guy catches it or he doesn't catch it. You know, it's that straightforward. It's not, oh, the ground forced the fumble or the ball to come loose, whatever. I remember hearing when I was a little kid, in fact, the rule as it stood then in the NFL that an incompletion cannot be forced by the ground. Now, let's go over how ambiguous that language is. Is it that if the ball hits the ground and then joggles out, is that then incomplete? Is that a no catch? Or is it saying that the ground can't force it, so since he carried it all the way to the ground, it is a complete catch? But that was the letter of the law. This, at least for me, is a lot more clear when it comes to that. It is better that the NFL can have a receiver making a football move or whatever it is. Thing is, though, it's still very different from college football, for one, which shouldn't the aim for both of these leagues to be to prepare players for the next level? I've always thought that 1 foot in bounds when it comes to college, and I mean, there needs to be some sort of consistency on those. But for the other, you know, these players just need to be prepared for what's to come in the NFL. I would worry a little bit about it being a potential third step requirement for a catch in the NFL, which I do not think should be the case. Like you said, tiptoeing the sidelines is a very important skill, especially for a top dog receiver who might be 6'4", might be Julio Jones, might be AJ Green, whoever it might be. But at the same time, this is better than previous. And right now, that's all we can hope for when it comes to the NFL. I think another good rule that they installed this year was ejections coming from a command center, because there are things that NFL refs cannot see and then can't review. There are those types of cases because, you know, the coach can only throw a challenge on a certain amount of plays, and beyond that, there are very strict limitations on when they can throw the challenge flag to begin with. So I think these were good rules for the NFL. Again, though, just use some common sense. Don't muddy the game up too much with official reviews either. Again, let's give some trust to the officials. Let them make common sense rulings, because at the end of the day, people like football because it's guys hitting each other. Let's not change it to something where every single play is under review. You can bring it back. I'm all for rulings in favor of safety. Again, I want ejections from a central office. I think that's fair. But at the same time, the game should not be slowed down any more than possible, because when you're watching that 60-minute game, how much is actually spent on the field? Let's not change that.
And I agree that this eventually we're just going to be playing flag football in the NFL, I think, is where we're headed with this. Just the inability of the referees to just make common sense calls, like you say. If you see a guy catch the ball, he caught the ball. If you see a guy drop the ball on his way to the ground, he dropped the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the rule with the ground forced incompletion should come back into existence in some way, shape, or form, where if you have the ball all the way to the ground and it gets knocked out by the ground, you still caught the ball. You didn't not catch the ball. So the ground forced fumble should be counted as a catch, in my opinion. Transitioning here, just to give you a quick Detroit Tigers update before we take this second break. The Detroit Tigers are now in the lead 2-0 in the bottom of the second. Iglesias doubled to left field, and Matuk scored the first point for the Tigers. And then Machado followed up with another double to left, and Iglesias scored. So the Tigers are on the board 2-0 here against the Pittsburgh Pirates in their first game of the season. Isaac had mentioned to me earlier that in the first inning, the Tigers loaded the bases and then failed to score. So we've seen it all from the Tigers here today as far as inefficiency and efficiency goes with back-to-back runs. And hopefully the Tigers will continue on this small amount of success to start the season and pull out a victory here on day one against the Pirates. Let's go to our second break. When we come back, we will finish the show and the week with Reflection Friday. You're listening to Current Sports here on WKAR. I'm Ian Hawley. Welcome back to Current Sports. My name is Ian Hawley. I'm filling in here today for Al Martin, who is away on vacation in advance of this Easter weekend holiday. Today on the show, we've been talking about the Final Four matchups scheduled for tomorrow between Michigan and Loyola Chicago, and on the other side of the bracket, Kansas and Villanova. Then we moved on to talk about some rule changes in the NFL with the 15-yard penalty for lowering your head to initiate contact with your helmet, and also the rule that revises what the standards are for a catch. I believe most of us picked Michigan to advance in the Final Four matchup against Loyola Chicago, and we were a little bit split on Kansas versus Villanova. If you'd like to call in and give us your comments here, we got about 6-5 minutes left here in today's show. But we will move on with our regularly scheduled Friday segment to Reflection Friday. All right, we'll start Reflection Friday here. Rusty Staub, a baseball legend who played for the Detroit Tigers, passed away this week, I believe on Tuesday. Staub played for 23 seasons in the Professional Baseball League with 5 different teams. We're also going to talk about Zeke Upshaw, a member of the G League Detroit Pistons affiliate, the Grand Rapids Drive. He was honored by the Detroit Pistons with an honorary call-up from the G League this week, and they honored him with a moment of silence before their last home game. So very sad to hear about the passing of Zeke Upshaw, Rusty Staub, and we'll move on here to a little bit brighter news. The latest class of Basketball Hall of Fame inductees will include former Detroit Pistons great Grant Hill. Hill will also be broadcasting the Final Four this weekend and the national championship game on Monday, alongside the great Jim Nance and Bill Rafferty. Le'Veon Bell, the former Michigan State running back great and current running back for the Pittsburgh Steelers, tweeted his frustration with his portrayal in contact drama with his team. Giancarlo Stanton's monster debut with the New York Yankees started off with a home run in his first at-bat as a Yankee. And if you're pretty much a fan of any other team in Major League Baseball, you hate to see this from the Yankees. But if you're a Yankees fan, that's what you love to see. John Simon, what were your favorite moments from this week in sports?
Well, not a favorite moment, but I definitely want to touch on the passing of Rusty Staub. Really one of the more underrated players in all the history of baseball. He unfortunately never made it into the Hall of Fame, but you know, he had a lot of years in Detroit. His more prominent years were in Montreal and New York with the Mets. I know that he was wildly loved by Expos and Mets fans. He was my dad's favorite player actually growing up for the Mets. He's the only player in Major League history to have 500 hits with four different teams, the Houston Astros, the New York Mets, the Tigers, and the Expos. And like you said, he was around for 23 years, had a great career, only 284 hits shy of 3,000. So really sad to see his passing. And he was a great guy after his career as well. Did a lot of work, you know, with the police and the firefighters of New York and any other city that he was in at the time. So just a real sad loss for the baseball community with the passing of Rusty Staub.
Fantastic player and a fantastic citizen. Tamar, what were your favorite sports moments from this week? Do you have any?
I would say Kemba Walker being the franchise leading scorer and passing whoever it was. I can't really remember.
Probably Gerald Wallace.
Yeah, Gerald Wallace or Steven Jackson. And also, just seeing Kevin Durant get his fifth technical this season.
Oh, you like
fifth
that?
Ejection.
Yeah, I kind of like that.
Fifth ejection. He's got 14 techs now. He's only two away from that one-game suspension if you get to 16.
You'd think playing on one of the best teams in the NBA, he'd be a little bit happier, but...
Well, I feel like there's a problem with the refereeing today in the NBA. Like, I feel like things are just too soft. If a superstar... Not even a superstar, but if, like, a player of that caliber, if LeBron and Kevin Durant, thinks that they got fouled, you should give him the foul because look at LeBron. LeBron complains about all of the fouls that he's getting and he hasn't been getting called for. And he has words for the referee, but he doesn't get a tech or he doesn't get ejected from the game. So if Kevin Durant does it, you know, why does he get kicked out the game? You have to be fair.
Those are some good points. Isaac Constance, your favorite sports moments?
I would say Kevin Durant had a little bit of this with him. So
sure,
yeah, I'm not so sure I can repeat that on air. There's a reason he got tossed. I actually heard what he said. But in any case, congrats also to Steve Nash and Jason Kidd for making the Basketball Hall of Fame. Two very deserving players and some of the best shooters of all time. They don't get credit for that, but they really are both some of the most efficient and spot-on shooters. Also, Detroit Tigers season opening day was yesterday. Let's get excited. Tigers fans, you're probably going to lose more than 100 games, so calm down.
Great to have you back, Isaac. We miss you while you're in Australia.
Great to be back, yeah.
All right, that's been our presentation of Current Sports. My name is Ian Hawley. We'll see you on Monday. Be easy, people.